The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 242 for Friday, February 5th, 2010. Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Geek Gab. It's not just for breakfast anymore, but today it is.
What?
I'm Dave Hamilton in Durham, New Hampshire.
John in front of Fairfield, Connecticut, and I have my breakfast, and also I have my freshly ground coffee, black.
Are you? Do you add water to that, or you just eat it kind of ground up?
Like? At least like, no, I don't just grind up the beans and eat them. I add some hot water. So
okay, that's nice. Do you filter out the beans, or do you just sort of let them filter through your teeth?
Nope. No, I use a conventional coffee maker.
That's good. All right. So we have, I'm traveling on Monday to Macworld Expo. I've got some things going on this weekend. So John and I figured the best bet, the safest bet was to get a show out today. And of course, we have more than enough material from all of you to keep us going. So let's dive right in and let's hear from Mike, because it's early in the day. And what Mike does is a great thing to start us early in the day.
Hey, John and Dave. Throwing you guys a cream puff today. I know it's going to be a piece of cake for you to answer this one, although I don't know the answer. I'm a Linux user, and if this was on a Linux box, I'd have it solved in about 20 seconds. Nevertheless, I've got an iMac here, a G5 iMac that my kids share accounts on. One of the children forgot his password. So as the admin who also has an account on the machine, I went in and reset his password. However, that worked fine. When he logs on, his keychain asks him for his passphrase so that he can have access to all of the authentications that his keychain provides, and the resetting of his password did not reset the keychain password, and because he doesn't remember his original password, we can't make use of that keychain. So I don't know if the only solution is to delete it, and if so, how do I do that? Or is there a way to change or reset the password for the keychain and maintain all of his credentials that he's stored up there in the keychain? Thanks a lot, guys.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks, Mike. And thanks for the cream puff. Although, you know, there's some nuances here, I think, John, right?
I don't think it's exactly a cream puff, though. We have to keep Mike's, he said he's a Linux guy, so we'll have to make note of that when we have a Linux problem.
Thank that's you. Right. Yeah, that's right. That's right. So to me, if you read the knowledge base and all of that, the simple answer is exactly as Mike, you described. When you reset the user account password like you did, it does not change the keychain password. The keychain password then needs to be changed separately. And in order to do it, you need to have the old password as well as whatever you want to set it to new. As an aside, if you keep the two synced up, it will automatically open your keychain if you choose that when you log into the machine. But for you, Mike, the official answer is no, there is no way. Now, I did read one report, John, and you can, I don't know if you saw this, but I did read one report that said, yes, that's the official answer. However, if you go into Keychain Access, choose Keychain First Aid from the Keychain Access menu and choose to repair, sometimes that will reset the keychain to the current user's password. Now, I've never experienced this, but it's certainly worth a shot, Mike, because the other answer is, abandon that old keychain, walk away. Do you have any thoughts on that, John?
Oh, I got plenty of thoughts here. So I dug into this and I have a number of suggestions. Now, first off, this could be an opportunity for tough love. I mean, children should learn that there are consequences to their actions.
Yeah.
No, I'm sorry. I'm not a parent. And I probably shouldn't be. Anyways. But Dave, you actually hit upon one thing that I found is that if you do go to Keychain Access, Keychain Access, Preferences, First Aid, there will be a checkbox that says Synchronize Login Keychain Password with Account.
Uh-huh. I think
that's an extension of what you suggested.
So maybe that has to be checked first before you choose Repair. Uh-huh.
That's my suspicion.
Okay.
Now, that's one option.
Yeah.
A second option, I'm going to give you three.
Good.
The second option, I noticed this in Keychain. Oh, another thing, back up the Keychain before you do any of these.
Yeah, and we'll talk, actually, give us the suggestions. We'll talk about how to back up and how to delete at the end so we can consolidate that. Yep.
All right, the other one I noticed, there's something, Keychain Access, Preferences, General, Reset Keychain Syncing. And the description of that, looking in the article, is changes the passwords used for Keychain Syncing to the passwords on this computer.
Okay, so that would be for mobile me syncing of the Keychain, I think, is what that's for.
I'm wondering about what they mean by syncing here. That's the thing I'm unclear on when they say syncing. If it's syncing the Keychain to your user accounts or to mobile me.
Yeah, my guess, I would have assumed mobile me, but
yes.
But I don't know. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah.
Okay, and then there is a third thing. There's a support article. I think it's mobile me prompted for password when syncing Keychains. And it's knowledge base article TS1181. And they have a line in there that says, if you are prompted for the Keychain password of a computer to which you no longer have access, or if you are prompted for a Keychain password that you do not remember, you can reset the master Keychain password file used during syncing. And it gets into some command line stuff that you can try. So
I think I read that article, and I think what they walk you through is throwing out the old Keychain file and starting a new one, essentially.
Which is
of course non-optimal, but I think unless you get lucky with the Keychain repair, Mike, I think that's the path you're heading down on this. So how to throw away the old Keychain, or how to back it up first before you start mucking with any of this. Go into your user folder, or the user folder of the affected user, go into library, go into Keychains, and in there, assuming it's Leopard or later, so 10.5 or 10.6, you'll see the main Keychain is named login.keychain. Now, if this machine has been upgraded through the years, and this goes for all of you, prior to 10.5 Leopard, the Keychain shared your short username. So for me, my Keychain's name was Dave.keychain, and there was no login.keychain to speak of, or at least not a login.keychain that had any valuable data. In 10.5, that changed, but if you've been upgrading through, you may or may not have made that particular migration. You may still have the old one. So the idea is, first, go in here and back it up. And to back it up, you can simply highlight the Keychain, go to the file menu in the Finder, and choose Duplicate, and just make a copy of it. You can leave the copy right there if you want, or to be very safe, you can drag it out to the desktop. That will make a backup. If you have to create a new Keychain, you just remove it from here, go into Keychain, and I'm not going to open up Keychain Access because it'll make your audio stutter, John, but maybe you can open it up and... I was able to get it open. Okay. And you go to the file menu, you choose new Keychain, and then you highlight, you make a new Keychain, call it login, then highlight that Keychain and go to the back to the file menu. And at the bottom, it says make login Keychain default, and then it'll become bold in the list. And then that should begin heading you down the path to resolution. Yeah. Anything there, John?
I suppose. And, you know, it may be worth considering having a strategy. Maybe have the kids scribble it down on a piece of paper and put it in a safe or something. I'm not kidding on this.
Yeah, well, with my kids, because this is an interesting issue. With my kids, I know their Keychain passwords. I know their user account passwords, and we leave their user account and Keychain passwords in sync. They've set them to things that they will not forget. But even still, I want to know their user password so that I can log in as them anytime. And that's just kind of how it goes as me being dad. You know, I get to be the benevolent dictator. There's no democracy going on here, you know, at least not at that level. Right. So, you know, that's how it goes. And then that way we never have this problem.
Or perhaps pick a password that is not so clever that you're going to forget it. And I think one common thing is to, you know, maybe replace words with numbers like four instead of F-O-R or something like that. But something that's not, because I noticed this is, you know, when you do create an account in the, you know, or if you do a password. Yeah. I mean, we're not going to go down the path of choosing a good password right now. That could be a whole episode in itself. Yeah. But try to make it hard enough to guess, or, you know, we're not so, I'm sorry, obscure enough to guess.
Obscure enough not to, for a non-informed person not to guess. Is there too many negatives in that phrase? We better move on. Yeah.
Yes.
All right.
Moving on.
To Jeff, and I got to find Jeff here. And Jeff, is this question and a follow-up kind of all baked into one?
Kind of a smackdown, I think.
Maybe it is a little bit of a smackdown. That's right. Yeah. Okay. So Jeff says, let's see. I'm seeing my thoughts to Jeff. I was very surprised to hear both of you say that you run in admin accounts all the time. This is very dangerous for many reasons, but the biggest reason is security. In fact, this is why Windows users are typically so vulnerable to malware, etc. They run with admin accounts almost exclusively. The big reasons for this is the default configuration for Windows and user accounts do not work very well in Windows. Because Mac OS X is based on Unix, which was always meant to have user accounts, Mac OS X does a very good job with user accounts. I have 5 Macs that all run non-admin accounts and have been for 3+ years. Occasionally, I run into an application that requires you to have an admin rights to install, but that's very infrequent. I never run in my admin account. Malware is rare for the Mac, but malware can do very little without admin privileges in Unix. This is a good practice for any Mac user. Admin or root privileges should be used when you really need them and not for everyday work. I think you should tell your listeners that this is a best practice. Okay. So smackdown received, and now but I have some thoughts. I guess I should share my, based on what I think you're going to say, John, I guess I should share my thoughts first and then let you counter. Is that sound about right?
Cuz you
okay. So on the surface, I agree 100%. User accounts are safer than admin accounts. However, it's important to note that in Mac OS X, there's actually 3 categories of accounts. There is the super user account, which has all privileges all of the time. There are what Apple calls admin accounts, which have, let's skip those. And we'll talk about those in a minute. And then there are user accounts, which have user privileges only all of the time. Admin accounts, which sit in the middle, are really nothing more than user. And correct me if I'm wrong on this, John, but I think I've got this right after my years of Unix as well. Admin accounts are user accounts that belong to a special group that allow them to gain admin rights by authenticating with their password. So the default account that you create when you get a Mac and it walks you through the beautiful little setup and all that, it creates one of those middle of the road admin accounts. More often than not, you're running as a user. If you need admin privileges to do something, the computer asks you for your password. This happens when, for example, you want to change your network settings, or you want to install an app into the applications folder, or make some other change that your user account does not have access to do. So it is a little bit safer in the middle there. Running as the root user, which would be the super user, all admin privileges all the time, is not safe. And I don't do that. Apple doesn't let you do that out of the box without kind of mucking with things. So that's why I feel safe in an admin account, because for the most part, I'm not authenticated up. And it's the same way that I work with our Unix boxes that we host on or whatever. I log into them. I'm a user account. I'm not privileged unless I need to make a change that's privileged. I use sudo because I'm doing it all from the command line. I go up, I do my privileges, and then boom, I'm out. There's usually a time limit that if you had inactivity, it'll bounce you out. And I think with Apple, it's 5 minutes. So that if you authenticate your account for super user privileges, it kind of bumps you out after 5 minutes of not using them. But I think that's right. Somebody will correct me if I'm wrong. So that's my feeling. That's why I do that. And you know, as an aside, Windows is based on VMS, right? Since Windows 2000, which includes XP and everything since then, which was also built for multi-user, back in the day of Unix. So I'll leave it at that. John.
Yeah. The Windows comment, I would say, and I think they've gotten better at this, but the problem with Windows in the past is that it wouldn't ask you for authentication when it did a lot of things. OS X, of course, does that quite often. And the newer version of Windows, though sometimes it gets really annoying, will put all sorts of warnings in your way when it detects something
Okay.
Unusual happening. So what I did is I checked this out. Now this is something I think we got to dig into a little bit. So when you create a new account, at least under Snow Leopard, you get four choices. You get administrator, you get standard.
That's
so what
right.
We're calling a user account is a standard account. Now, interestingly enough, when you create a standard account, there is a checkbox that says allow user to administer this computer.
Which would then make them an administrator account.
Or does it?
Yeah, it does.
Okay, that's kind of silly then. So why not? Because you can just create an administrator account.
I think standard. So. Yeah.
Managed with parental controls. This
that's
is
right.
what you want to do for the Wii ones.
Sure.
Because it lets you block applications, block content, all sorts of things. And then a group account, which I'm not going to really bother with that. One thing I did notice when creating the account is that it has a password suggestion icon, which is kind of interesting. I think it's been there for a while. It kind of helps you pick a decent password
yeah.
under different categories. So you'll notice that next to the password field, there's a little icon. You click on that and it'll help you pick a nice password. But where I would look, just to get the authoritative word here, macOS 10 help creating a new user account. I'll link to this article and explains the differences between the type of accounts and a standard account. Standard account users cannot administer other accounts, but can install software. Okay, so that's cool. For their own use and change settings related to their account.
Sure. Right.
And I would say, I don't know. I'm not going to change my ways. I'm still going to run as administrator.
Yeah.
Though I did create a user account just to get the experience, and it's different. And when I tried to click on certain things in system preferences, it would say, you got to give me administrator password to.
Right. To and see, this. See, that's the thing. And to me, again, somebody correct us if we're wrong on this, but the way I interpret it, when you went to say try to change network settings in system preferences and you had a standard user account, it said, no, you can't give me your password to authenticate. You have to give me the password of a root user, of an administrator. It's not a root user, sorry, of an administrator user. And you could do that and you type in the short username and the password and boom, it lets you do what you're doing. To me, that's no different than having an administrator account and having to enter your own password, unless it's a different person, right? And you don't want a certain person to be able to do it. But for me, if I'm going to know the administrator password, well, why bother typing that? Why not just use my own account? I mean, it's the same difference there. So that's why I live with the administrator stuff and I'm totally happy with it. It hasn't burned me yet. And my guess is it hasn't burned many, if any, people yet, because if it had significant impact, Apple would change it on their end and change the defaults.
I guess. So the standard account. So in a multi-user household or enterprise or whatever, I would tend to agree that a standard account is probably a good idea for your regular everyday user.
Yeah.
And the person who hopefully knows what they're doing, or the owner or the administrator is the one that will take action when you approach the computer when it does prompt for that admin password. So I think I would tend to agree with his point that standard account should be the default. For other users.
For other users, yes, but not for the first main user. If it's a single user machine, no reason to. But yeah, multi-users, absolutely. In fact, on the machine at the house, I have an account for me, which is an admin account. And then I have an account for Lisa, which I think is also an admin account because she's used to that on her machine. And then for the kids, I've got a kids account. And then I also have it's a guest account, but not a guest account. It's an account for guests to use. And the kids account and the account for guests to use are both standard user accounts, and they have no password. That way the kids or a babysitter or whatever can get on the machine. They can do what they want to do, but there's no hope of them mucking. Well, I mean, they're limited from being able to muck with system wide settings. So,
and the guest account, if I'm not mistaken, at least under Snow Leopard, there was a warning because I'm looking at my machine right now and I have it disabled. I think there was a hole at one point
There was an issue with the guest account where you could actually delete data from other accounts, but I believe they patched that up. So
I have it disabled, though.
Yeah. Yeah, I do, too. I think it's disabled by default. All right. Our first sponsor for this show is Barebones Software with Yojimbo. Yojimbo is an information organizer, for lack of a better term. I use it for a lot of things. I have it all in one place. I have data for Mac Geek Gab. I have little text snippets for Backbeat Media. I've got little text snippets for, Macworld Expo coming up. all, and I'm able to organize them into little collections, but they're all in one place. And it's not just text. We have the audio files. In fact, Mike's keychain password question was played right from Yojimbo straight to the show live here. We're able to organize the show notes there. I can put PDFs in, I can put images in, and they all just appear in a big list. And I can sort them any way I want. I can find by name, I can find by content, and I couldn't live without it. It actually syncs all of the data, no matter how large, using MobileMe. And that way I've got Yojimbo on every computer. I prep the show down on my MacBook Pro in the office. I come up to the studio and boom, all the data's here, right, ready for me to go. So this is Yojimbo from Barebones Software. It is available, of course, for a 30-day free trial. Once you're hooked, $39 for an individual license, $69 for a family pack, which I believe gets you three licenses, and educational if you're a student or teacher or otherwise qualify, $29. So all available at barebones.com. Last show, John, we talked about defragging, and Mr. X has a tip actually to share.
Hey, Mr. X again. I have a PowerMag G5 with two hard drives, and the second drive, the data drive, I do defragment that on a regular basis because I use Pro Tools with it. And basically, when I start recording, it'll want to grab up to 8 chunks of up to about 4 gigabytes apiece, and then whatever it doesn't actually end up using of that, it frees back up again. So you run out of contiguous 4 gigabyte blocks pretty quickly, and things can get kind of gnarly after that. So anyway, I do run iDefrag on my G5 because I use Pro Tools with it. And anybody that works regularly with very large files like video or audio files is probably more prone to need defragmenting a little more often. That's it. Bye.
All right. Thanks, Mr. X. It sounds good to me, John.
I agree, and I actually do like his strategy, which if you're doing this sort of work, to have a separate drive just for manipulating large blocks of data, or even in general, you may want to have another drive to store your data, and one drive for your apps and all that stuff, and maybe I like that suggestion, and he brings up a good point when you're dealing with big wampin files, either for sound or video, that things could get messy quickly.
Cool. All right. Moving on to Chris and John, I'll let you take this one, because though we both are married to the solution that I believe we're both going to recommend, you turned me onto it many, many moons ago.
Hey guys, this is Chris in Orlando. You guys did an excellent job in recommending a program called Afloat for keeping the calculator always on top. I appreciate that. It's exactly what I needed, and it filled the order exactly. Another question I have has to do with file folders. I do a lot of uploading of images throughout the week using various websites to upload these images. And the frustrating thing about this is that the process is that you choose the file folder and it immediately opens up Finder. I go to the storage card from the images that I took on the camera, and then I have to click through a few more file folders to finally get to the image. And I do this for about a half a dozen times, and then finally it decides to immediately open up that file folder where the images are stored, and eliminating me to click through two or three more file folders to get to that file folder with those images. But then I have to go to another website and load up images there, and I start this process all over again. I upload anywhere from 1,000 to 2,000 images a week, doing anywhere from 50 to 60 of these assignments. So anything I can do to eliminate keystrokes or click strokes is obviously over a period of time very time saving.
All right, we'll stop there. I think we've got the point, John.
Suffice to say that the answer to this problem, and I've been using it for years and years, and I think you have too, Dave. I think I turned you on to it.
You turned me on to it in OS 9 days.
Oh my gosh!
I know.
So our friends at St. Clair Software make something called Default Folder 10. This is what you want. And specifically to his point, it has two choices. So what happens is it changes the file dialog that comes up when you do a save or an open or anything like that. The two choices that he's going to like. So one is recent folders. So it actually remembers the folders that you've been to recently. But even better, and hence the name of the program, is you can make a choice saying use whatever your folder in as default folder. Voila. When you open a file dialog, you are right in the folder that you want to be. So to me, that in of itself, because typically the built-in, you know, file navigation in a lot of OSs isn't that wonderful or smart, and that goes to a place that, of course, you don't want. The other feature that I really like about default folder is that when you open it up, I think it's an optional mode, but if you want to pick a folder that is on the desktop or visible on the desktop, if you hover over it and then you click, it'll snap default folder to that, which is just so any of these modes, I think, would solve his problem.
Yep. And I've also found it, the whole snapback thing, where if I go to a folder, especially in Safari, this seems to happen because I have one machine. I don't know why I haven't installed default folder on it, right? The iMac at the house. Again, don't ask me why, but I don't have it on there. And what I notice the difference is between that and the other machines that I use is if I'm in Safari and I go to navigate somewhere and I navigate there doing just what Chris describes and I get there. OK, great. I'm here. Now I do my thing. The next time I go to do that in Safari, it feels like it brings me somewhere else more often than not. And with default folder on the machines that I use it, it just brings me right there. It's like right back to where I was. And I don't know if that's just a fluky thing. I don't know if it's a problem that default folder fixes or if it's some other issue on that machine. But I sure like the machines with default folder a whole lot better. And yeah, like you said, if you've got something open in the Finder, you can just float your mouse and click on it and it brings the file dialog right to that location. It's awesome. Awesome. I'm the one thing I'll say is I'm shocked that Apple hasn't duplicated this functionality. And I guess they have to a degree, right, John? Because when you're in the Finder, you have the folders that you can add to the sidebar of all the Finder windows, and those are available, right? You know,
Mike, that's a good point. If he doesn't want to get default folder, though, I think he should. Yeah, he could always create a something in the sidebar that he can get to quickly as well. Drag a folder over there.
Yeah, yeah, and that does work. It's a poor man's default folder, I'll say. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Cool. On to Rick with a good tip. Actually, we've talked about in the past. Where if you have a recurring problem with your machine and you've brought it into Apple multiple times and you can document that, then you can call Apple's customer relations, which is different from AppleCare, although it helps if the machine in question has AppleCare. You can call Apple's customer relations, or sometimes the AppleCare reps will do this, and you request, look, I've had problems with this. Effectively call the machine a lemon, though you may not choose to use that term. But, say, look, I've had enough problems. I've been very reasonable about it. I think we're at the point where, you know, this machine is due for replacement, and they'll look at your account and, you know, if it's warranted, they'll replace the machine. And Rick's going to explain a little bit more about that and then something that you can do. It's a helpful hint.
Hi, John and Dave. This is Rick from Long Island with a tip I found. If you're ever in the situation where Apple has decided that they are going to replace your broken computer, at first I was happy that they were going to do it. Then I was unhappy because I was going to go from a top-of-the-line model to what was now going to be a bottom-of-the-line model. So I asked them, could I upgrade? And they said, sure. They will allow you to make almost any upgrade, and you just pay the difference on the retail price from the standard one that they offer you to what you want. So that way I was able to upgrade and end up with a top-of-the-line machine instead of the bottom-of-the-line that I was going to get. Keep up the great work. Thanks.
Thanks, Rick. And what Rick points out is that Apple will try and spec match your machine. So, you know, if it's a year old, as you know, in his case, it may be that the top-of-the-line machine a year ago now has the same specs as, you know, essentially the same specs as the bottom-of-the-line machine now. So that's why they went from his older top-of-the-line to newer bottom-of-the-line. And like Rick said, he was able to pay the delta and update. So upgrade, which is good. Anything
yeah,
to add?
I had it happen to me. Yeah. The thing was, my machine was like at the end of its life. It was my PowerBook G4.
And, you timed that. You timed that as perfectly as I did with the iMac G5 that I replaced here in the studio. Yes.
And I think when I bought it, I think I bought either the top of the line or close to the top of the line. So I got something where the clock speed was like doubled. So I was thrilled. And,
sure.
And from what I understand, the machine is, it was the most powerful PowerBook G4 that you could get until they stopped making them. So,
right.
Excellent that Apple will give you the opportunity to do that.
They're pretty, I have to say, I mean, you can't ask for something unreasonable. You know, if you've had a problem where, you know, they haven't even let them try to fix it yet, they're not going to replace it, right? But they are more than reasonable about replacing your machine. I've been through it. I have to say, I think I've been through two of them. Now, of course, I bought tons of machines from them, so they're okay with it. You know,
well, with me, it was, I believe, six back and forths using Airborne when Airborne existed. So they were already losing their shirts on overnight shipping and just time on the phone. And I said that to the guy at one point. I'm like, you know, you're losing money every second you talk to me. And he's like, yeah, I know.
Yeah.
And he did it for me. So, yeah, but again, six back and forths to me, I think was at the edge of what was considered reasonable to try to fix the problem.
Yeah, that sounds about right. All right, cool. Moving on. Matthew has a couple of answers and a couple of questions.
Hey, John and Dave.
Nuts. All right, we're back. Let's see if we can make this work again. I don't know what causes this stuttery thing, John. I do. It's interrupts, but I don't know. You know, when they started, funnily enough, when I upgraded from the iMac G5 as the recording machine to the iMac Intel. So they must handle hardware interrupts differently. And since then, it has been an issue that has chronically plagued us. Here we go.
Hey, John and Dave. In episode 227, you talk about iStat menus being a pain to set up on a.
You know, I will stop again and say that Matthew's question has some of that ticking in it anyway.
He has the crackle.
Yes, he does. That's on his end. So we'll let him continue about it. iStat menus.
New computer. I haven't tried it, but I would guess that you could just copy the preference file from a previous setup. This is called com.icelayer.istatmenuspreferences.plist in your preferences folder. Also, I once asked you guys about how to get rid of the hollow stars in iTunes. These are a problem since they were messing up my smart playlists. I've since found out how to get rid of them. Over at Doug's Apple Scripts for iTunes, there is a script called Album Rating Reset. Once run, this will get rid of the hollow stars on both albums and individual podcasts. Now I have a couple questions.
All right.
One, in iTunes, is there a way to trim an episode of an audio or video podcast down to just certain parts and still keep it in with the other episodes of its podcast? And two, in Front Row, under podcasts, some of the podcasts are listed twice. For the most part, each will contain different episodes, though sometimes there is some overlap. For example, the Mac Geek Gab will show up twice, and episode 83 shows up under each, though the rest are different. Hope you guys can help, and thanks for all you do for the Mac users of the world.
You're too kind, Matthew. Thank you for your answers and tips and all of that. All right, so first question, John. iTunes trimming. The only way that, there's a couple of things he could do here, but in iTunes, if you want to trim it down to just one section, I think you can do that by highlighting the song, going into info for the song, which is file, get info, and then go to the options tab and edit the start and end times. That will keep the file. It'll actually keep the file intact, but only play the portions that, between those start and end times that you've set. Otherwise, you're going to have to get an audio editor to edit the file. If you're going to do that, you know, most podcasts are an MP3 or AAC. I like Rogue Amoeba's Fission because it allows you to non-destructively edit that MP3. So it's not going to re-encode the MP3 when it saves it, which is actually magic, if you ask me. I think that's pretty cool. So that's my thoughts on it, John. Do you have any thoughts on it?
Quick thought. I do believe that the QuickTime player will let you... cut and paste or chop out parts of an audio file. Though I didn't take a moment to try it, or even GarageBand, I believe.
Yeah, Yeah, those are definitely, that would definitely work. I've got
but I don't believe they're non-destructive, and you got to, of course, you know, dig around and find out where the audio file is. So I think either one of those, if you got those kicking around, but I like what you said. Non-destructive to me is always good because once it's gone, it's gone.
Well, and it's compressed to begin with. Sorry, I got an oil truck backing up in my driveway right outside the window. I like the non-destructive thing, and I just think it's cool that they figured out how to do that, because that's like magic, right? I mean, to edit a compressed file and not change it, that's crazy, dude. All right, John, our second sponsor for this show is a new sponsor for us. It's GoTo Assist Express from Citrix. Now, this is the same people that use GoToMyPC and also GoToMeeting, which many of us have probably used for webinars and things like that. The idea is, you know, we've all been through this we've all been through this on one end or the other. You're on the phone talking to someone and you either want to help them with their computer by reaching out over the phone and touching their computer, or they want to reach out over the phone and you want them to touch yours to help you fix something. And having to walk someone through that over the phone can be a nightmare, right? I mean, we've all been through it. It's very frustrating. You're playing operator and you're not asking someone to be your hands and eyes when they don't know what you're looking for is very, very difficult. So definitely a huge time saver to be able to reach out and do this. And so that's exactly what GoTo Assist Express does, is it allows you remote access of a computer with permission, without having to be there and without having to set anything up first. So, John, you and I tried this morning. Now, I set it up as the controller and you were the controllee, right?
Yep. It was very easy. So you sent me you sent me a URL.
Yep. A URL that you opened right in Safari, right, John?
Open up in Safari, and then it brought up a little Java icon. The beauty of Java, of course, is it can run on multiple systems, including this is on my G5.
Yep.
But didn't think anything of it. Clicked, you know, gave it permission. There were a few dialogues asking for permission to do things. And of course, our friend Little Snitch, which I know you hate, came up and asked for permission on, I think it was pretty much your standard ports, 80, 443, and another one.
That's great.
So I think that's good because, you know, those should get through any firewall. And,
right.
And it did.
Right, right. Oh, that's smart. Yeah, okay, cool, good. And so once you gave permission, it said on my end, all right, you know, here you go. And then boom, I saw John's screen. I could interact. There was a little chat client. We could chat back and forth. And at any time, John had a big red X on his screen. He could hit that and I was gone. There was, you know, totally privacy, protective of the privacy. There is a way to set up an unattended session there so that if you want to, you know, if you want to give someone access to your computer while you're not there, that can always happen. You can try GoTo Assist Express free for 30 days by visiting GoToAssist.com/gab. That's GAB, all lowercase, GoToAssist.com/gab. And we really appreciate them coming on board as a sponsor. I think it's a great fit for what we do here and for what you all do there. All right, John. So are we going to go stay in questions or move on to tips?
We could do Brent. You want to?
Yeah. All right. Sure. Yeah. This is good.
Hey, John and Dave, I've got two things. The first, I'll start off with a tip, and the second one's going to be a question. So I was looking at Omni Disk Sweeper on my MacBook Pro that has a 200 gigabyte internal hard drive, and I was looking in /private/var at a log file that was nearly 20.
I gotta hold on to this. I don't know what's causing this. All right, we're back. This is driving me crazy. I don't know. You know, we went months without this plaguing us, John, and then now it's back. Now, the thing is, I'm still on Leopard on this machine because I was afraid to update to Snow Leopard to make it worse, but maybe it doesn't matter now. All right, we'll let Brent start over because I wanted to hear.
Hey, John and Dave, I've got two things. The first, I'll start off with a tip, and the second one's going to be a question. So I was looking at Omni Disk Sweeper on my MacBook Pro that has a 200 gigabyte internal hard drive, and I was looking in /private/var at a Samba log file that was nearly 21 gigs in size. And after digging around the Apple discussion forums, I saw that there was a couple of threads going on it about other users having the same thing in Tiger or possibly Leopard. And this is a Snow Leopard machine, by the way, that it's 21 gigs in size. And so is it safe to remove that with a cocktail or something like that, or just remove it manually? Or to have a cron job to automatically delete that once a week or every night, once a month, whatever else. So why does the file get to be that big for Samba? Is it automatically created anytime the Samba is sharing is turned on? What would your recommendations be to remove that file safely and to keep it small? Anyway. Later, guys.
All right. Thanks, Brent. All right, John, let's actually hold off on his question on this, and let's talk about what's happening here and maybe how to figure out why this file is continuing to grow. And then we'll answer the question.
Well, Samba. So Samba first, I do believe that is your Windows print and file services.
Correct. If you want to share your disks or folders and printers with Windows, when you turn on Windows sharing in the sharing tab, that's the service that it turns on is Samba, S-A-M-B-A. So,
okay. My one thought, and I found an article that talks about this, OS X should be, maybe not this file, I don't know why, but should be with one of these maintenance tasks that it runs. Should be clearing that stuff out. And I did find an article, Mac OS X, how to force background maintenance tasks for logs and temporary items. And this is certainly a log.
Right.
Although we've received mixed information on that, this article claims that OS X may not always run all of these maintenance tasks when it should.
That's right.
And if that's happening, this article tells you how to invoke using OS X facilities, or it mentions several third-party utilities that will whack them. Of course, you can go into that directory. Though from what I saw, the files are locked down. I think you'll have to do a sudo. I like saying sudo. I don't know why. Sudo.
Yep.
And whack that particular log file. You cannot do it. Another way to see this log file, by the way, and just to peruse them, though I do like Omni Disk Sweeper, the console utility will let you see what's in your private /var directory. But as I mentioned, and it will give you a delete option, but for those files, it does not. Again, they're locked down for some reason. I guess maybe because they're in private, which... Yeah. So those are a couple of my thoughts.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I think opening up console and taking a look at this log file may give you an indication as to A, how old it is, right? Because you can scroll all the way to the top and see what the earliest date stamp is. Usually these log files, every entry has a time and date stamp. So you can get a feel for, okay, is it getting rotated by these system facilities and just growing at an alarming rate? Or has it been years since this file's been whacked? But you'll also, if you scroll down to the bottom and scroll to the most recent entries, you should see what's been added to it or what's currently being added to it over and over and over again. And it might give you indication to say, oh, hey, wait, you know, if it's just, you know, every second reporting to the file, unable to open this folder, unable to open this folder, unable, you know, you might say, oh, maybe the permissions on that folder aren't right. And now it's reporting this to the log file, you know, over and over and over again, ad nauseum, right? So that's the first place I would look. Then, yeah, I would use something like Cocktail or Onyx. I like Onyx because it's free, but Cocktail also works. It was my previous favorite, and I'd you know run the periodic scripts, or you can use Omni. I guess Omni Disk Sweeper won't whack that file, right, John? Is that what you said? It should. I think you might have to authenticate as root. So, got to do it.
Yeah,
as an
I looked at the
user
permissions, and they seem to be for the most part read only. So, yeah. It may ask you for permission to do that.
Yeah. So, yeah, but you're safe to whack it. The one thing is, sometimes with these Unix services, if you go and delete their log file while they're running, that's fine. But it may not create a new log file until the service starts again. So you may have a situation where the service thinks it's logging to a file that no longer exists, and so it just goes away. That's what I've seen with other things. I've never tried it with Samba, but you may not care. In fact, Brent, that may be desirable behavior, because then at least you don't have a log file growing. So maybe you create an Apple script that does it and run it at startup, so it goes and blows away the log file, and then there's nothing for it to write to, and you're in good shape. Unless, of course, you need your Somalogs. All right. Let's go to follow-ups here, John.
I got one in
the last show. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm so excited because I figured this out. So, and unfortunately, Ben did not leave an email address. So I hope you're listening.
I have Ben's email address, but he listens. Oh. Yeah. Ben is
excellent.
Yeah. To prep it right in the last show, Ben from the PMUG, Princeton Mac Users Group, had a question about VirtualBox and printers, right, John, where he could use his printer sometimes, but not others. And it depended on his networking settings, whether he was sharing right. or getting his own IP address. Okay. Yeah.
Right.
Got it.
So, I'm going to admit that the initial advice that I gave Ben was not very good.
All right.
Well, I kind of dismissed it as, you know, I don't have problems with this. So why should you? Number one, so he was talking about being in VirtualBox and having printing issues. And so I'm like, you know, I'm going to try this just because this is kind of bugging me because I've never had a problem with it. And I mapped my my laser printer, which uses TCP/IP or TCP, was able to print to it just fine from VirtualBox as a printer. And I'm like, cool. And then I just got the shiny new HP B8550 Photo Smart printer, and it's hooked up to my time capsule. And it is shared using Bonjour. Now, of course, Windows, or at least Windows XP, doesn't have Bonjour built in. So I downloaded, and a side note, Bonjour for Windows does work under Windows 2000, which he said he was using. So even though, I said you should probably go up to XP, I don't think that was the problem. Or it was not the problem. I'm going to tell you right now, it's not the problem. Here was the problem. So while I was trying to solve this, and I'm going to give a tip of the hat to Philip, because as I was trying to solve this, I was on the right path. So I tried to add the printer. When you install Bonjour for Windows, you get a little thing called Bonjour Printer Assistant, I believe. And so I ran that. Up comes, HP PhotoSmart B8550. I'm like, great, it sees it. That's cool. Go to the next dialogue, which then asks for the printer driver. And then all of a sudden it said, oh, the printer's gone. Sorry. And I'm like, what? Here's the problem.
Okay.
Here's the problem. Then I'm like, I'm going to have to just read the documentation. Now, as we pointed out before, what happens is by default, which works for most purposes, VirtualBox will do a NAT connection. And I verified that. So my Mac had 172 dot whatever, and the address within VirtualBox was 10 dot whatever. So it was like doing a NAT to NAT.
Okay, just to make sure we're keeping everybody in the loop here. Mm-hmm. NAT is the magic technology that lets one device share its IP address with many others, usually used by your router, gets an address from the cable modem, shares it to all your computers. In this case, your cable modem gets a router. Cable modem gives your router an IP. Router shares it to your Mac. Mac shares it inside the Mac to VirtualBox. So we had this double layer of NAT, network address translation. Go ahead, John.
Which for TCP traffic, which is, your browser and connecting to that other printer, that works great. Then I'm like, I'm going to have to read the documentation. So I read the documentation for VirtualBox, and I don't know if this is a VirtualBox issue or a NAT to NAT issue, but it said, oh, and by the way, NAT doesn't really reliably or will drop UDP packets. The thing is, Bonjour for Windows uses UDP. This right. explains why the printer was appearing and disappearing. So, and then I got just as I was going down this path, we got an audio comment, which you'll see from Philip, and he hit the nail on the head just as I was hitting the nail on the head.
Okay.
Going into VirtualBox, shutting down the virtual machine, then going into the settings. If you go to the network settings, I changed the method of grabbing an address or the interface definition from NAT to bridged. And then it gives you a choice of which interface would you like to bridge to. And it lists a bunch of them. And I was using wireless or airport at the time. So I said, all right, you know what? Bridge to my airport instead. So restarted VirtualBox. I looked. And then my IP address was as if it was another computer. It was another 172 address.
Okay. So it was now, instead of getting an IP address from your Mac, it was getting an IP address from the router and an equal participant on the network now.
Yes.
Okay.
And then I went to add the printer. It showed up, went to add the driver. It stayed there, went to print a page to it. Everything worked great. So the solution here, and I don't see any reason why you wouldn't want to do bridged. NAT is a good thing to start with, but one reason you would want to do bridged is if you want to talk to UDP devices. So NAT is probably good for most uses, but if you're doing anything beyond basic surfing and TCP/IP work, you may want to choose a bridged interface instead.
I've I noticed with not just with VirtualBox, but with most of the Windows, you know, virtualization stuff, Parallels and VMware, when I look at the default settings, and I'll be the first to admit I haven't used, actually, I just installed VMware over at the house, but I didn't look at the network settings because it simply worked. But I think by default, they all use this NAT thing. Now, that's probably the safest bet, because the assumption is if your Mac is able to get on the internet, then there's no question your Windows machine is able to get on. You know, if you set it to bridged and you're in some sort of corporate environment where, you know, the router might say, hey, wait a minute, why is this one Ethernet device requesting two IPs and it might reject one? And then you've got this crazy thing where you're like, well, how come it doesn't work? You know, my Mac works. So my guess is that's why the NAT setting is a default. But in your home, definitely you're better off bridged. I agree with you 100%, John. You know, maybe traveling, you want to use NAT, right? So that you don't get this weird double IP thing happening, and you don't, because you don't know the management of the network. But if you've got a standard, you know, Apple or Linksys or Netgear router in your house, they don't care. They'll assign up to usually like 50 or more addresses, depending on how you have them configured. You're not going to run out of address space. So I think you're cool doing it that way.
Yep. So case closed.
Yeah. Awesome. That's great. You know, let's, okay, so his case is closed. Let's talk about this. Have you compared, John, VirtualBox is similar to VMware, Fusion and Parallels. It is a way of running Windows or other OSs on the Intel architecture of your Mac. So it's not emulating a Windows computer. It's virtualizing it and allowing those OSs to talk while inside your Mac. The one key difference about VirtualBox is it's free. Have you done any comparison, John, between VirtualBox and Fusion or VirtualBox and Parallels and just kind of feature parity or anything like that?
I have. So
with recent versions or?
Yes.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah, I did one thing at work where actually someone was like, you know, we got this program that runs on the PC and I want to see if it runs in a Mac VM. And, you know, can you hook up this device and see how it works? Great.
Yeah.
The USB support in VirtualBox for non-printer devices is lacking, because okay. I ran something that did not work under VirtualBox. It just did not see this USB device. Now, again, it was a non-standard device. It wasn't a, you know, printer, sure, or something like that.
Sure, so, but it worked in one or both of the others?
In VMware.
Okay.
It worked fine in VMware Fusion.
Okay, so, cool. Interesting.
Another thing I think VirtualBox is lacking is that it doesn't seem to be able to grab, it only seems to be able to grab about half of the RAM that's in your machine.
Okay.
And then my is only set up for 2 gigs because I have 4 gigs in my MacBook Pro.
Sure.
Another thing is that I think the graphic support is lacking, though they have experimental 3D drivers. So if you're a gamer, VirtualBox may not be, or doing anything that's graphic intensive, I don't think VirtualBox is your best choice. On the other hand, the price is right. So,
okay. Yeah.
VMware Fusion, I had the best experience with when I was doing this test.
To be thorough, I don't really care about being fair. Did you try Parallels as well?
No.
Okay.
No,
all right. So this was just a VirtualBox Fusion comparison. So we don't know how Parallels stacks up there. Okay.
Yeah, I couldn't find it in the pile of stuff I have in the office here. So.
Sure. Well, you know, that's one of those things. You know, next week at Macworld Expo, these software companies and hardware companies, they shower us with this stuff. But and sometimes it's a real pain, but it does turn out to be very handy for situations like this, where it's not something you would go out and buy because you're going to use it regularly. But for testing, it's like, oh, yeah, is it in my, you know, is it over in that cabinet that just has boxes of software? Yeah. All right. I'll install it. If not, nope. OK. So
the vendors keep the love flowing.
Yeah. You know, I'm of the opinion that if I'm going to use a piece of software for my work or for recreation or whatever, I buy it.
But, oh, likewise.
You know, but if it's something where, you know, I'm not going to use it, but I don't buy it. But it, like you just pointed out, it's handy to have this stuff around. So interesting. Okay, cool. I'm glad that we headed down this path, because that's probably valuable. I would say to sum it up, at least comparing it to VMware Fusion, VirtualBox is great if you simply want to run very standard, you know, Windows non-gaming applications occasionally, or browse occasionally, but otherwise, you know, the reality is you're going to spend money on Windows anyway, because you got to buy the Windows OS. So, you know, the extra little bit for Fusion or Parallels to have a more robust system might be a better option. But, you know, if you got a free copy of Windows sitting around from an old Windows machine, hey, VirtualBox and you're golden. Right?
Yes.
Right. Dan, last show, we talked about, we lamented actually about the lack of good money management software, personal finance software on the Mac. And many of you wrote in about this next thing that we'll let Dan share. And I couldn't be more thrilled. I haven't tried this yet, but I'm very intrigued.
Hey, John, Dave, this is Dan calling from Kingston, Ontario in Canada. I'm listening to episode 241, where one of your callers called in reference to finance software for the Mac platform. Well, I was a Quicken user like yourself and that caller for years, and I switched over to the Mac. In doing so, I did some digging and found a program by the name of MoneyDance, moneydance.com. I've been using that for a couple of years now. Their latest release was just out about a month ago. It has filled the household finances perfectly. Very, very powerful program. Lots of reports and accessories within it. And soon to be released, as per their blog, is the iPhone app to... So if you're on the road, you're on a run on the roads, or you travel quite a bit, you can do your finances on the iPhone, and it syncs up Wi-Fi directly to the application. Everything is put in. Looking forward to that, and this is where you can cut me off. Cheers.
Awesome. Thanks, Dan. Man, I went and looked at this. It does online banking. It'll import from Quicken. If it lives up to even half the claims that it has, the screenshots look great. Like I said, I'm really excited. I'm going to get through tax season here because I've got a system that, you know, just gets me through tax season. But then I'm going to experiment. I'm going to import our, you know, Quicken data file with 15 years of data in. And I'm going to mess with this because, you know, Quicken's supposedly coming out with their next rev of their Mac software in February 2010. Well, John, we're in February 2010. Now, they might be planning to announce something at Macworld Expo next week. I honestly don't know. But, you know, the fact that Dan said an update for MoneyDance came out last month that actually added features as opposed to just fixed bugs certainly makes me a lot more optimistic about that than what we've seen from Intuit over the years. You still with me, John?
I'm with you.
Okay. I was almost ready to blast off into a rant, but I think I said my piece.
They're getting there. They're getting oh so close.
Intuit's getting close? No, dude. They fell off that bridge a long time ago, and they're trying to climb back on.
What is it, like the Duke Nukem Forever of...
Wow, I like that.
Because I think people are still, you know, even though I think they pretty much said we're closing up shop, there's still people saying, oh, but I got another trailer that shows the latest.
That's right. That's right.
People don't... I think this is a game that has been on the Windows radar for 10 years.
Yeah. Yeah,
and I think they actually had a write-up recently in Wired about what a train wreck the development process has been.
When it finally comes out, it's going to be this fully immersive virtual reality 3D experience where when you get shot, you actually bleed. I think that's when it finally comes out, the technology will be there.
All right, but on that note, Dave, I think we got to talk about how you want to get in touch with us.
That's right. Feedback@MacGeekGab.com is the place for all of you to email us, unless you're a premium subscriber, in which case premium@MacGeekGab.com is the place to email.
Mm-hmm. I think you said feedback@MacGeekGab.com, but
you heard me. I said feedback@MacGeekGab.com.
Or you could call us, and the number is 206-666-GEEK, which is
4335. You can see the great show notes that are put together every week.
Thank you.
By our own Mr. John Braun at MacGeekGab.com.
I tweet out an alert on Twitter, if I may take a... Yeah. So on Twitter, if you follow MacGeekGab, as soon as the show notes are done, I send out a little tweet saying, come and get them. So if you would like an instant notification, because sometimes, depending on what's happening in my life, it may not come out immediately. So,
Sure. Twitter. Let's see. Twitter.com/MacGeekGab for that. Twitter.com/John F. Braun for John. Twitter.com/Dave Hamilton for me. Twitter.com/Pilot Pete, even though we haven't seen him in a while. And Twitter.com/Mac Observer for all the other stuff. We are going to be at Macworld Expo next week. Thursday night is our party. Friday night is the Macworld Blast Party, at which Paul Kent's Silicon Valley House Rockers are going to play. Now, both of these parties require a ticket, and those tickets are not necessarily easy to get. For Cirque du Mac, we do have the secret link, but it's tight right now. I'm not sure how many more we can add. Doesn't hurt to try it out, though, because, you never know. So sign up at the secret link, but I can't make any promises. However, John and I will be on the show floor Thursday, 12:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, doing a live Mac Geek Up. We'd really like it if you come to that. And usually after that, we're both quite gregarious and generous, and we will almost certainly have tickets not only for our own Cirque du Mac party that night, but we will also have tickets to give away for the blast party that Macworld is throwing the following night. So there you go. Definitely come check that out. I do want to take a minute to thank the sponsors for Cirque du Mac this year. That's Verbatim, Circus Ponies, Smile on My Mac, Microsoft, eCelerate, and Project Wizards with Merlin. So thank you to all of them, and thank you to all of you for everything that you do. iPhoneAlley.com is where Michael Johnston is when he's not converting the shows to AAC for you here. CashFly, CacheFly.com provides all the bandwidth. The podcast marketplace includes the A2 speakers from Audio Engine, Yojimbo from Barebone Software, PDF Pen from Smile on My Mac, Notebook from Circus Ponies, and GoToAssist.com/Gab for a 30-day free trial of GoToAssist Express. That wraps it up, John. It's time to get on with our real days here.
Yep.
Because this is like our fun time. I love these shows. I really do like the morning shows. Mm-hmm. It's fun. See you next week for Macworld Expo. And if you're traveling out there, be careful going through a security theater. Don't get caught.
Made up.